This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week, we'll continue our January series, just as we did in 2018, of taking this month and chatting with composers, creative forces worth getting to know. This week, we'll chat with composer and pianist Eric Moe. Born in Southern Illinois, he became an accomplished pianist before seriously turning to composition, and he built his career as a founding member of the San Francisco-based Earplay Ensemble, but he now teaches back on this side at the University of Pittsburgh and runs the Music on the Edge New Music Concert Series in that city. His music has many winning traits, such as exuberance, as noted by the New York Times. He combines many music elements and genres and styles, fearlessly at times clashing and combining pop, rock, jazz, and classical into a sound that is his own, and that also in many works presents and flaunts a trait missing in so much quote-unquote serious music, which is humor. You're listening to the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, led by their director Gil Rose, in the third movement of my guest's five-movement work, simply titled Superhero, forcing one to think of a comic book set to music. This is the third movement titled Rescuing a Planet in Distress. I spoke with Eric Moe by phone a few weeks back. Happy to be speaking with composer Eric Moe. I'm speaking with you, and you're out on the West Coast.
Yes.
You're actually born on this side of the country, sort of raised in the middle of the country. I'm a Chicagoan, but you were in Southern Illinois.
So yeah.
Very different experience. Came back out here, right in our backyard, Princeton University, but really your career started again out in the West Coast, San Francisco. You were part of that famous Earplay Ensemble, and now for a number of years, professor of composition back on this side in Pittsburgh. So, crazy question, but since you would be a good one to ask, here in the 21st century in 2018, almost 19, is there still an East Coast, West Coast divide, a difference? Are there regional aspects to American composition, composing that you know of or you can see still?
I think it's fading. I think it used to be much more chiseled in the old days. In the bad old days.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot more fluidity now and movement between. I mean, I don't think you can go to a new music concert in San Francisco and expect to hear Lou Harrison-influenced pieces where, you know, you might have, you know, expected to hear that, whether you did or not.
Right.
But, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago. So, you know, I think there is it's not homogenization, actually. It's a lot of people doing a lot of very different things all over the place. So I think that's healthy for our ecosystem. But I still think that the center of gravity in the country is still weighted towards the East, just because there are just more composers.
Right.
And more ensembles and more musicians.
Yeah,
I mean, New York and Boston and Chicago now.
Yeah, I mean, out here, of course, we're very New York-centric. I was just curious, I mean, as you travel around and you get students teaching for many years at the University of Pittsburgh, I mean, there's probably a little bit of a pride factor. You see recordings come out saying, you know, composers from Colorado or something like that, you know. So there's probably a pride, regional pride factor, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And, you know, I have thought of, you know, do we have a Pittsburgh School of Composition? Because there are, you know, some, you know, wonderful composers there now and increasing numbers because it's such an affordable, you know, nice city to live in.
Right.
These days, you know, it's now that nobody can afford to live in New York. a lot of Brooklyn is moving to Pittsburgh. But, you know, it's not really, you know, it's like, so what would that school consist of? You know, this, my colleague Matthew Rosenblum, superb microtonal composer,
and, yeah.
You know, my other colleague Amy Williams, who's, you know, wonderful explorations of timbre and rhythm. You know, it's just like, you know, aesthetically, it doesn't make any sense. We just all happen to live in the same city.
My guest composer Eric Moe as pianist performing his Dance of the Honey Monkey. Thank you. Give us a little background on you, because you're an exceptional pianist, composer. Just curious, how'd you get down this path? Was the piano first, composing on it? Were you writing pieces? I mean, how did you merge into then the creative end of it with also the performance end?
It's a good question. You know, when I was a kid, I played piano.
Right.
And I didn't think much about composing because I didn't even know how to go about learning how to do that until I was in high school. And, you know, it wasn't until I got to college that I was really able to figure that out. But I did sort of run out of music that I wanted to play. I mean, I sort of was an avid sight reader when I was a kid. So I read through all of the repertoire and sheet music I could get my hands on, which was a lot.
Yeah.
Because there was a university library nearby. But there was something missing, and what that was the stuff that I needed to write. So I started figuring out how to do that in college and graduate school, and I sort of kept the piano chops up. But, you know, there were a lot of great pianists around, and I knew early on that I wasn't going to have a career as a concert pianist, and that didn't appeal to me, for one thing, just learning all the concertos, and it's like, it sort of seemed like servitude. But then in grad school, I started hearing my piano music, or, you know, piano parts and ensemble pieces being played, you know, rather haphazardly. And I thought, you know, I could do better than that. So I, you know, became an active performer again, and, you know, started and, you know, helped start a new music ensemble. And, you know, it was great. At the time, the Bay Area, there was a shortage of good pianists in the Bay Area who wanted to do new music. So I had a niche to fill, you know, and I like it. And I like the sort of the mixture going back and forth. I think it keeps me honest as a composer, to keep some profiles as a performer.
You know, a lot of the younger, I'm talking under 40 sort of generation of composers, that composer performer is very much in vogue. And you know, to be a pianist is great because you can do so much, you know. The closing minutes here of Mud Wrestling at the OK Corral, composed by my guest today, Eric Moe, David Russell on cello, and Mr. Moe on piano. To get into some traits of your music, but before that, so as you decided I'm going to create music, wherever that was, and I mean, I read somewhere where someone's, oh, his influences range from Chopin to Hendrix. I think both of those are short-ending the stick. But who, when you started Create, who were you listening to? Who were you interested in that some of that was going to creep into how you wanted to write music?
Wow.
When you started, yeah.
I did listen to a really wide range of stuff. Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was in high school, Bartok was really a big influence. But then, you know, I quickly discovered early Schoenberg, and that stuff was just so far out. I loved it. The Suite, Opus 25, it's just a fantastic piece. I thought, wow. So that was a real brain bender, but and mind opener. And, you know, of course, the great models of older music, late Beethoven sonatas, and things like that were always in my mind. But that's just piano stuff. I don't know. I mean, I didn't listen much to bebop and rock and roll until I got to college. Hmm. But then once I did, you know, that seemed to me to be a, you know, the rhythmic vitality and the just the sheer velocity of, you know, like Bud Powell's piano playing. It's like, oh my God, yeah. You know, wouldn't it be great to do something like that? So, you know, all of that stuff did make its way in there or tried to make its way in there. Or sometimes it took me a while to figure out how to incorporate it. It always was a pretty wide range of stuff.
When you were doing your college university studies, you're of the age where there were a lot of dogmas and systems and you need to write this way type of thing going on. Getting to your music, there isn't any really adherence to any strict 20th century process of any kind, really.
No.
Never was, right? Was there?
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No, there were some, you know, when I was learning, there were some studies, you know, I tried to write 12-tone pieces. I did write 12-tone pieces. They're not very good, so I quickly stopped doing that.
Right.
It wasn't for me, but, you know, there's still a lot of wonderful music that's serial, and you know, I certainly care about motivic procedures in a lot of pieces, and sometimes with a fair amount of rigor, but that's not really what I was fortunate, to answer your question, I was fortunate early on to have my first real composition teacher was Paul Lansky.
Oh, okay.
Who was, you know, credibly anti-dogmatic himself.
Right, yeah.
And just wonderfully open-minded, and he showed me just, you know, how much variety you can take and what you can draw from all different kinds of music to make your own interesting and all the possibilities. Because I think there's a tendency for young composers to, this is the right way to do it. I better do this or I'm not going to be one of the cool kids.
Right.
I mean, I see it with my students. And it's just so sad, and I just want to shake them and say, no, there's more.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are, you know, knowing Paul's output, of course, him so many years here right in Princeton, and there are lines there. Yeah, you can see that. Here are the final minutes of a work titled Danger, Giant Frogs, coming from a sign my guest saw while visiting Lake Como in Italy. Performing is the percussion ensemble Taluhong, music by my guest today, Eric Moe. So some of these traits, and the first one is the most musical of the trait, if you want to put it that way. And you already mentioned it a bit, but I think, and it's been noted, one of the really strong points and focal points of your music is rhythm, whether you're writing for percussion instruments or acoustic instruments or even electroacoustic music, electronic music, something like that. So rhythm has always been there, and your approach to rhythm, because it really is a strong point, I think, when you listen to your music.
Mm-hmm. Well, almost all the music I love has very strong pulse-driven, you know, aspect to it. And for me, it's an important part. Even if it's very slow music, there's still, you know, something driving the music forward. The relation of music to time seems to me just utterly integral to it. And I've played pieces that, you know, squeeze time and expand it in wonderful ways. I played the Morton Feldman's Patterns in a Chromatic Field, too, which is a 100-minute long piece or something like that. You know, it's a wonderful experience. It's a wonderful experience to listen to, but that doesn't interest me as a composer to write. Actually, that piece has a lot of pulse. I mean, it is, you know, it is notated throughout. There is a sense of pulse that you have to feel as a performer anyway to navigate from one end to the other. But the sense of having some kind of relationship, a strong relationship to pulse, it allows you to do is to create some sense of expectations and then to satisfy those, or more fun, to frustrate those in an interesting way.
Right.
And that's, to me, what, you know, what it's all about.
Even more than pulse, I mean, when I think I'm more talking about rhythm, is like what you can be listening to your music, and I don't know how to phrase this, that the rhythms can be whatever, you know, they can be catchy, they can be engaging, whatever, but they don't seem contrived, which means it doesn't mean like you're just starting up this rhythm to keep the piece going. If you get my drift, that's, you know what I'm trying to say? That there's a...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, the other nice thing about it is, or, you know, working with, or not being afraid of rhythm, the way a lot of my students are, is that, you know, it allows you to sort of dip in and out of, or to refer to other genres without sort of quoting them in an annoying way, and it allows you to create really interesting sort of, I guess, mashup is maybe a better word.
Yeah.
But you can combine a rhythm from West African music, you know, with Steve Reich found this out. You know, you take a West African rhythm and you put it with a music that would never be found in West Africa, and you get something that's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Just all by itself. The old nail two things together that have never been nailed together before. You have an invention. A stupid way of thinking about it, but...
I'm Patty. Humor abounds in my guest Eric Moe's music. Here are the opening minutes of a work from his latest CD, the work titled Let Me Tell You About Our Specials, with flutist Lindsay Goodman performing alongside electroacoustic sounds, including words spoken to us all at the restaurant we find ourselves at so often.
I'm Patty. I'll be helping you out this evening. What can I start you off with? Can I start you off with something? What can I start you off with? Let me tell you about our specials.
second trait here, and this is rare still, and it's becoming more common, especially with younger composers, which is good to see. Throughout much of your output, there is humor. And
yeah.
that is such a pleasant thing. And it can be from the contrivance of the piece. What's the piece with the No Time Like the Present, where, you know, what happened to Stravinsky ended up in Detroit and had to experience Motown as he was doing his 12-tone music rather than Hollywood. And that can be the premise, but it also can be within the music. There is humor. There are things that are funny, both musically and in the texts, and we'll get to texts. But just mm-hmm. the fact that you see your music, or again, you see that humor has a place in your music. And mm-hmm. actually, it seems like it's almost at times you want it to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that does dismay me, or dismayed me when I was younger, was that in the concert hall, everything was very, very earnest.
Right.
And deadly and often slow paced. You know, very serious. You know, it's like they called what we wrote serious music.
Right.
And everybody took that way too seriously. So, but more important is that to make humor work, to make comedy work, you have to have surprises. And since I value surprise, you know, you can have comic surprises as well as tragic surprises, tragic revelations. And, you know, those two are, comic surprises are actually harder to set up. So I liked the challenge of doing that. I mean, it helps if you have a text that has something in it that,
right,
you know, lends it more weight. But it's possible to do it in instrumental music too.
Yeah, no, I hear it in some of the just strictly instrumental things you do as well. Like I said, it's just, it was lacking for a long time. And it's funny that you mentioned mm-hmm. serious music, because usually the opposite of that is popular music, which is just like ridiculous. There's one reason why it's popular. You know?
Yes, right.
Exactly. We don't want to be serious all the time. It's just funny that those are the two poles. From my guest Eric Moe's one-woman opera titled Tristan, based on a story by David Foster Wallace that casts modern Hollywood as a Greek myth of our time, featuring a hero named Agon Emnar and a heroine named Sissy, deftly mixing high and low culture, social parody, and music parody, where music of Richard Strauss and Richard Wagner rub elbows with pop culture notables such as the theme from the Brady Bunch. Here is mezzo Mary Nessinger with the ensemble Sequitus in the seventh section of this opera titled A Starlet Is Born.
Long jaded viewers were rapt, Vanna's show stolen, critics indulgent, and sponsors all but manic. Stasis even taped the thing up at home. Sissy Nar got a guide cover and a Variety profile. She became, as BBE ran like clockwork, every 23 hours, a high RF light in the small screen firmament, albeit somewhat typecast, for Tristan's FG respondents did attest with one voice that they loved Sissy for, not despite her eerie enactment of the vegetative state. Her morphine passivity touched a chivalric nerve, apparently. A market for large for whom is yet more remote and unattainable and thus desirable than the oblivious. Whatever the source of Sissy's unconscious allure, the industry found it good and thus recombinable, an original SNN reshuffling of a Norse myth of Siegfried, with Sissy as a narcoleptic Brunhild, was rushed into reproduction. Dyspeptic men in worsted blends to meet far by air, to feel both stars out re-merchandising tie-ins for straight. leggi ecco a Venice, late of Tristan and recumbent party, more recently of obscurity and the Beaufort Clinic, and even more recently of the erythemic Robert Vaughan's Sibilant and Iagia late night campaign. Gotten progressively more effective. After many liters and quarter ounces and very short prayers over glass, pipe, and flame, diplomatic relations between our echo and reality had pretty much broken down.
The other three traits I had are all in one way connected to one another, and they're all connected to the humor too, but so they're not in any particular order, but you have not been afraid in your works, whether it's in the texts you choose or even some of the music you quote, to deal with current events within a very American vernacular that is almost time-stamped. That can have a danger, I think, and that, you know, when the time moves past that, I'm thinking of like your one woman op in Tristan, right? You know, where
yes,
there's Mozart in there and there's Wagner. There's also the theme from the Brady Bunch. There's a whole listing of sitcoms that have long been on TV Land channel and whatever, you know. Talk about using things that are of your time, knowing that that time's going to pass.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think composers have always done that. I mean, fortunately, if the piece is good enough, there's, you know, a certain durability to that that just sort of transcends the sell-by date expiration of some of the references. I mean, you don't want a piece that requires a lot of footnotes for people to understand.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know. It doesn't bother. I mean, what we do is so ephemeral anyway. But the other thing is, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with placing things securely in time and in a time milieu. I remember playing Tristan once for a bunch of students in Georgia at university there. And, you know, this was just a few years ago. And I thought, oh, my God, these kids are so young. They won't get any of this. But, you know, as the sitcom, this sort of sitcom theme parade rolled by, they were in stitches because they had seen these all. They'd seen their parents watching reruns of these or something like that. You know, it wasn't unfamiliar to them. So, you know, actually pop culture references may be more durable than art music references at this point in history.
Yeah, it's sad. It's like plastic. It'll never go
away. Yeah, exactly. Right. Still washing up on South Atlantic Island.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was thinking of. If you want to stick with Tristan for a second, you know, there's a lot in there. And there's, of course, there's the classical end of it, too, with the Wagner and all that stuff. I said, but I was thinking, boy, could this thing play in, you know, 2080 somewhere? And I don't, you might be right. It might be able to.
Yeah.
I always think it's a bold move when composers, either with their text or even just musically, sort of put their piece right in of a time, like you said. And, you know, I just think it's a bold move. Tying into that are texts and what you choose for texts. So how do you filter? I know it probably depends on the piece and all that, and sometimes you're asked to set a certain text, but how do you go about choosing text and filtering what will work for you?
Yeah, well, it's I've set such a wide variety of texts.
Yeah, you have.
It's hard to come up with a single. Well, first of all, it has to resonate with me just in some way. Long confessional poems, you know, I think that's a heavy lift. I can't figure out how to set those because they seem just to be so much about literature and not so much about sound. I mean, it has to be something that where the language is musical enough to want to be expressed aloud. So even with the David Foster Wallace text, you know, these incredibly long sentences with incredibly long words like thanatophiliacal and mithridatic, which are not all that easy for a singer to wrap her lips around.
Yeah.
The language works amazingly well and spoken aloud. And, you know, it's a real challenge to set long sentences with vocal music. It's why Broadway song lyrics are always, the lines are so short.
Right, yeah.
Because you know where the verb is going to be right around where the noun and the subject are.
But I mean, when you read a text, some composers, it's like immediate. It gets filed away. I will do this at some point. Or do you have to live with it? Some composers memorize it and, you know, mutter it to themselves while they're going shopping or gardening or whatever. You know, I mean, how does it finally make the grade? Whatever it is.
Well, yeah, I toy around with some, and then, but it's usually, you know, I mostly, almost entirely write from people commissioning me to do stuff.
Right.
It's often a negotiation. And sometimes it's just, there isn't much negotiation. Like the soprano Christine Brandis out here in California asked me to set some of the Rilke's sonnets to Orpheus.
Right.
And she wanted the Stephen Mitchell translation. And so I was a little skeptical of doing it in a translation, but then I looked at his translation, which is fantastic. And I said, well, if I can get the rights to this, which I could, then this would be fantastic. That was a no-brainer. Other things have not been quite as easy. Same singer asked me to do a Mary Oliver sequence, and whose poetry I'm not particularly fond of, but I looked into it, and I couldn't get the rights.
Right.
She's not allowing people to set her words to music anymore. So I was actually secretly happy about that, because then we were able to find some text by Mae Swenson, for my money, much more interesting poet for musical setting. And, you know, that was a happy compromise, as it were.
On the other side of the text coin, before we leave this, you're talking about poetry. You've also said
yes. A
text has to be worth it. I mean, one thinks of a poet, because there's a lot of mediocre texts that have been set over the centuries, which are now standard and elevated because of the composer, not because of the wordsmith. So, I mean, just talk about that. And too, I mean, there has to be something where it's got to have some inherent worth to the text, I guess,
Well, I like that. I mean, it certainly makes life easier. Or inherent interest, let me say.
Okay.
I remember setting, I have a song cycle called Siren Songs, and one of the songs is a setting of an eyewitness account by, I don't know who the guy was. It's in the 17th century, someone who was in Newfoundland and saw a mermaid. And, you know, he's not a great writer, but it's a really interesting account. So I found a way to set that I was happy with.
Final thing here is you have set some texts that if Tipper Gore was still around slapping stickers on CDs, or what the comedians would call blue language, just the choice to go ahead and do that. And, I mean, the obvious question would be, does that cause problems about getting a work like that publicly performed? I'm just curious.
Yes.
Short answer,
actually,
yes.
I've noticed that on iTunes, some of those pieces actually have clean version available.
Oh, wow.
You know, like with what they used to do with maybe they still do with rap hip hop albums.
Yeah.
But and then you listen to the clean version, it's the same, by the way.
Wow.
I was really interested to see, did they really do bleep out the no, it's mostly a problem not so much with venues but with performers. For some reason, there are singers out there who will not sing certain words. I do not understand this. I mean, can you imagine an actor who would say, I'm sorry, I can't say that word on stage? But there are some who won't do that, and so it occasions some balkiness. But than others, it's more than balanced by those who, all right,
finally,
I get to sing this, finally.
Yeah, I mean, when you were doing the composition, you had to know that, well, I mean, there are going to be some, put it that way, either.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's.
I was just surprised by how many there were.
From an English translation of the poetry of Rilke and my guest's song cycle, Sonnets to Orpheus, this is the sixth song of the eight-movement work. Christine Brandis is the soprano. The group for contemporary music is led by J. Carla Lemon, music by my guest today, Eric Moe.
Thank you.
As we have talked through this, I think our listeners are hearing, well, put it this way. I want you to talk about this quote from you. It says, making art is a lot more exciting when big risks are being taken. And I think in the music they've heard and also in what we've talked about, you are one that in your compositions like to take risks, like to do things. I mean, either whether it's the titling of the work, whether it's the music itself, whether it's the text you choose, how you said it. I mean, just talk about that sort of living out on the edge rather than in the comfy couch type of thing.
Well, I think it's a personality issue, but yeah, I mean, it is more exciting as a composer to... Well, let me give you an analogy. I like to climb mountains in my spare time. I mean, I don't do death-defying things, you know, where if there's a good chance of dying or serious injury. But I do like climbing mountains, and I often climb alone, which people give me a hard time about. But, you know, there is a degree of excitement that you get from not sitting in an armchair or not doing the comfortable thing and doing something that's difficult. I mean, just to see if you can do it. It doesn't always work. I mean, that's the sad part is that, you know, sometimes you fail with risks and then you have to tear the piece up and start again or write something else altogether. But it makes things interesting. I think one of the biggest grossing movies right now is about a fellow who did a solo climb of El Capitan in Yellowstone, I mean, Yosemite.
Yeah.
And, you know, people want to watch people taking risks. I mean, there is something exciting about that.
Yeah.
Did he really do that? Whoa. So, you know, it's like, why not try?
I mean, as a composer, I mean, you're not going to look at your list of works and find, you know, Symphony number one, String Quartet number two, Abstraction number three. And so, I mean, every piece is going to have its titling and its music content and the texts it chooses. Some kind of direct thing you're trying to get across. And like you said, with the risk taking, I mean, it's just, it's riskier being a composer that way. But I guess maybe nowadays, and I don't know what you tell your students either on this front, but just to take the risk. And like you said, sometimes it'll work and sometimes it won't type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is, I think one of the reasons why I'm allowed to, why it's easier for me is because I have a teaching job, and I've always had a teaching job, and I don't like living on the edge, you know, in terms of, you know, whether I'm going to be able to pay the rent or going to have enough to eat in a given month. So that's always given me the freedom to, okay, I don't have to have a huge career. I can have the kind, you know, a weird career where, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm noticed and sometimes I'm not, and, you know, I don't have to set up a consistent brand of things and churn out reliable pieces that people can count on to do X, Y, or Z. So that has given me a certain amount of freedom. And I think for younger composers, especially now, it's hard to imagine, well, it's hard for anybody to imagine a day job where they're able to sort of work in one place for, you know, 20 years or 30 right. years.
It's interesting because we talked earlier about the academic side of when you were going to school, and it was mm-hmm. all rooted in academia then. And what thankfully, it mm-hmm. looks like it's now moving out. But,
right.
you know, academia can still be growing. What's ahead? I mean, some composers are superstitious, but maybe tell us what you're working on now. And are there things that you got, like, a plan down the road of either genres or something you want to do that you haven't tackled yet?
Well, I can tell you what I'm working on now.
Okay.
I'm working on a piano concerto for the Boston Modern Orchestra project.
Okay, great.
It's going to be piano and keyboard, and the working title is Extreme Weather. And it's going to bounce off all of the storm. There's all this great 19th century storm music, you know, the storm movement in Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. There's a nice storm in Strauss's Alpen Symphony.
Right.
There are many, actually.
Right.
So it's a great genre. But, of course, storms and weather have now an existential meaning for us as a species. So it's, you know, it's sort of an interesting territory to explore. And musically, I'm interested in not just in that, but also in trying to rethink a concerto so that it's, you have a keyboard that can play samples of whatever, or just to expand what a soloist can do. So in addition to a regular old grand piano, to have another whole other orchestra of sounds available to the soloist to counterpoint with what the orchestra is doing.
Is this written for a particular pianist, or?
So far, it looks like I'm playing it.
Yeah, to you. Okay.
So, yes, it is written for a particular pianist.
I mean, you've done multimedia works. Is the larger operatic canvas of interest to you or not?
Well, I've written a larger, you know, sort of a full-length opera, 100-minute opera.
Okay.
And actually, I have not yet succeeded in getting an opera company interested in it enough to to produce it.
Okay.
So I'm still working on that. But it, you know, it is a different world. It's not a world I spend a lot of time in as a composer.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of necessary to flourish in that world. So I don't think I'm going to go back into that anytime soon. What has always interested me more, or what has always interested me, are these sort of moves in towards dramatic or operatic presentation that don't take place in an opera house. So Tristan
right.
is a one-woman opera in a concert setting with video to provide movement or a very unusual, something more than a standard concert song cycle program experience. And I have other pieces that use media to, I mean, I think we're not limited to an opera house anymore, or even a groovy new opera, chamber opera space. Elaborate staging, we have video projection, and technology can help us out a lot.
Yeah, I mean, there are operas being done which are definitely not for the stage. They're being done, you know, I just interviewed a composer not a while ago who did an opera in Union Station, you know, as an experience type of thing.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, a lot of technological nightmares in there, especially
yeah.
when they start announcing the trains. But
yeah.
Well, keep it all going. I'm a fan, and there's it's such a wide range that you put out. It's like I wouldn't know what was next. I mean, you said the piano concerto, and I, like if you said guess what I'm doing next, I wouldn't have been able to do it. So that's the thing, you know.
Yeah, well,
that's good.
I like to surprise myself as well. I mean, I guess I'm not a person who plans out what's going to happen in the course of a particular piece.
Right.
And so since I'm averse to that, you know, I'm much more interested in seeing where the piece takes me. And since I'm that way with writing single pieces, I'm also that way when writing the next piece.
Right.
I'd like to surprise myself as well as
anybody who's
paying attention.
keep it all coming. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting, but with mm-hmm. someone from the past who you never had a chance to talk to but could. When I ask that, sometimes you can get flooded with names. But when I ask that, what was the name that popped in when I asked that?
Wow. Gee. Man. Oh, man. many, so many.
Yeah, I know. The first one that just, you know, and then you tend to get flooded, but just two.
Well, it would be the 20th century guys who I love so much, like Schoenberg and Stravinsky.
Yeah.
Those are the guys I'd really love to sit down with and try to cut through the polemic of their writing, or, you know, the provocativeness of their writing, and try to find out what they really thought about things.
Yeah.
It's mostly because I've been reading about both of them a lot recently.
You invite them to a great diner in Pittsburgh and have both of them sit there and see what they say. If they talk
to
each other.
It'd be interesting to get them in the same room.
Yeah, if they would talk to each other. Final question's non-musical. You already mentioned one thing, and we should say, I don't think you honed those mountain climbing skills in Southern Illinois anytime when you're growing up. But everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy with everything you do. But when you have to step away and do something that is pleasurable relaxation, but is non-musical, what do you do if you need to get away from it for a while?
Yeah. Well, I have a piece titled Strenuous Pleasure.
Yeah.
And that is what I like.
That is what you do.
So long hikes, backpacking,
okay,
mountain climbing, not technical mountain climbing so much,
right,
but scrambling to the top of things.
Right.
It's what it allows me to do is I get the sublime experience of landscape, and then it opens up a whole range of things to thinking about the sublime in art. And, you know, I am very much influenced by the 19th century romantics in that way.
Well, Eric Moe, thanks for taking some time.
Oh, thank you for your interview.
Composer and pianist Eric Moe. You can find out more about him at his website, Eric, E-R-I-C, Moe, M-O-E, .net, ericmoe.net. Recordings of his music have been released on the Albany, Boston Modern Orchestra Project, or BMOP, New World Records, and his latest on New Focus Recordings. Since he spoke of his next piece being a keyboard concerto, I leave you with the final movement of a work that is a piano concerto in all but name. The piece is called Kicking and Screaming. Alex Karras is on the piano. The Speculum Musicae is led by Donald Palma. Music of my guest today, Eric Moe. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today. And I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.